We're going to continue our discussion and our thoughts on the book of Daniel, beginning in chapter 8. In chapter 8, we see where Daniel receives a vision, and in this vision, he is seeing things that are going to transpire that have to do with the land of Israel. And has to do not only just with them, but with all of the known world at that time. So far throughout Daniel, we have seen a couple of visions that have been given. We saw the vision of the man that Nebuchadnezzar sees that speaks of the four kingdoms. We saw the vision of the tree that stood for Nebuchadnezzar and him being brought down, humbled down, and then brought back to his sanity. We've seen where Daniel sees a vision of four different animals, and each one of those beasts that he sees represents one of the kingdoms. And in this book, in this chapter here, again, we are given a vision that tells us about these kingdoms. Now, the important thing to remember here is that these visions were given years and years before these kingdoms came upon the earth. In other words, when he sees Nebuchadnezzar's vision, it's years before the Medes and the Persian take over Babylon. Now, Daniel's still, of course, alive, and this is all going through the 70 years of captivity that he is over there in Babylon, along with the rest of the Israelites that had been taken over there by the king of Babylon. In the beginning of this chapter, he says, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, now he's back under the time of the Babylonian Empire with this king. Even though, and as we said before, Daniel's not laid out chronologically in order. It was laid out pretty much about some of the visions and the miraculous stories that we saw, such as those of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the miraculous story of Daniel being thrown in the den of the lions. And now these last chapters deal with prophecy. So they were not put in here chronologically because Belshazzar, that is spoken of here, is a king of Babylon. And we've already read prior to this where the Medo-Persian Empire had taken over Babylon. So don't look at this as it's in a chronological order because it wasn't laid out that way. So here we see King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in a vision, and I was by the river of Eli. Then I lifted up mine eyes and said, and behold, there stood before the river a ram, which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. So now, Daniel here, he sees a ram, and this is a great ram, and he has two horns, and one horn is larger than the other horn. And he sees it, and it's running forth, and it is taking whatever land it wants to take. Now, this is a kingdom that he's seeing. He's actually, in this vision, it's going to be interpreted to him that this is a kingdom and which is going to be transpiring. Now remember, this kingdom, as the Medo-Persian Empire that's being talked about, isn't come yet, but is going to very soon, from the time in which this chapter was written. Beginning in verse 5, he says, and as I was considering, behold, a he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth, and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground, and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Now he sees a goat, and this goat, he says, has one notable horn to it. And he runs with color towards the ram. In other words, he's very mad, full of anger, full of just wanting to destroy this ram. Now, he's speaking here of the Grecian Empire. And Alexander the Great, under the Grecian Empire, conquered the Medo-Persian Empire, which is this ram, and the two horns represent the Medes and the Persian Empire. The goat, the Grecian Empire that comes and runs after him, he says, is not touching the ground. This is an analogy that shows to us the speed at which Alexander the Great did his conquering. When he came out of Greece and he began to conquer, he did it very quickly. And so it gives to us, it didn't take years and years and decades. He was a young man when he started, and he was a young man when he died, and he had conquered all the way over into India. So it tells us that he moved at great speed is what he's talking about here. The reason he went against the ram with such anger and is because of the many times that under the Medo-Persian Empire they attacked Greece. Now, Greece, during those times, was not a country that was gelled together. They were a democratic country, but you had like the empire, you had the kingdom of Athens, you had the kingdom of Sparta, you had different different kingdoms within the big kingdom of Greece itself. And they weren't gelled together. Well, when the Medes and Persians started attacking Greece, it caused them to start gelling together, to become a nation, because they had to rely on one another to defeat this enemy. So some of the movies that you've seen recently that's come on the scene, about 300, about King Leonidas of the Spartans at Theophilus, and some of the other movies that have come out display some of the battles that happened between the Medes and the Greeks. Well, because the Medes had gone up into Greece and they didn't conquer it necessarily, they just attacked it, it created great animosity up there. And you can go back through history and read how that the Greeks, who were trying to colonize places in the world, had colonies over here in the Medo-Persian Empire. And when these colonies would call for their help, they would send troops over there. This is what really started the whole conflict between the two. But it came down to just a downright hatred between them. And that's what he's speaking about here. Now, he then says that this big horn up here is broken. That it gets broken in two. That means that that kingdom or that king of that kingdom dies. And that was Alexander the Great. And out of it, he says, comes four other horns. Now, that's because when Alexander the Great died, he had no heir. He didn't have any blood heir to himself. So what happened was his kingdom got divided amongst his four generals. It got divided amongst Ptolemy, amongst Seleucia, amongst Lysimachus, and Macedonia. Now, we'll read on in verse 9. And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which was waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. And it waxed great even to the hosts of heaven. And it cast down some of the hosts and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practised and prosper. So out of one of these horns here comes a little horn. Now I think because he uses it as a little horn, he is speaking here of one of the kings that comes later through these four generals. And it was through the Seleucidas was where they came from. And this one little horn, and we're going to talk a lot more about this little horn when we get over into the 10th and the 11th chapters of this book. But this little horn is an individual that was known as Antiochus the Fourth. Now, Antiochus the Great was one of the rulers here of the Seleucid Empire. And then after him, after he passes away, his son comes on board. Now, his son, Antiochus the Fourth, not only takes this title, but he also gives himself the title of Epiphany, which is the title of a god. And so you're going to see how all this fits as we go through and we read the interpretation of the visions that is going to come after this. In verse 13, he says, "Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, Unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed." So this little horn that comes about is going to wreak havoc upon Jerusalem, upon the temple, upon the people of Judea. And he's going to do this for 2,300 days. Now that word day there is actually interpreted as a morning and as an evening. So really you're looking at 1,150 total days. You're not looking at 2,300 total days, since it was given as a broken up. Now normally in prophecy, when it's given and a day is given, such as in the 1,260 days or the 490 years that we're going to see coming up here in chapter 9, or you go over to the book of Revelations and you see 42 months, you see a time, times, and half time, you see 3.5 years. These are all times that deal in days, and each day becomes a year for that prophecy. Because this was given in this event, in this way, it doesn't appear that the year-to-day prophecy would apply, but simply that a day would apply. And it was by coincidence, not by coincidence, but by the Word of God, because he realized this, that this little horn up here who attacks and removes the worship in Jerusalem, that it occurs for this span of time. And we're going to learn more about that as we get into other chapters. In verse 15, he says, "It came to pass when I, even I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man, and I heard a man's voice between the banks of Uli, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. And he said unto me, Understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground, but he touched me and set me upright, and he said, Behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be." Now, what Gabriel's here to tell Daniel is the interpretation of what he has just seen, and we pretty much covered a great deal of it. And it's the time of the indignation. Daniel, you remember, is in captivity over in Babylon. He's away from his country. He knows that over there in Jerusalem, the old temple lays waste. He knows that the city lays waste. He knows the gates are down, the walls are down, that there's all kinds of people running all over the land over there, that it's just not the way God had wanted them to be. He knows why they've been taken out of Israel. And his concern is, when are we going to go back and be able to worship like we want to worship and like God wants us to worship? That's what he's really concerned with. And it's being told to him that these kingdoms are going to come on the earth. And during the time of these kingdoms, Israel's going to be restored back, but not to ever to the restored back like it was under David and under Solomon, because they're actually going to be under the rule of somebody else from now on. Because remember, he saw a fourth kingdom. This is the second kingdom. This is the third kingdom. And the Roman Empire is the fourth kingdom. They're never really going to have their freedom under these kingdoms. They are going to be able to build the temple. They are going to be able to go back and worship. But during this period of time, this little horn here is going to come along and is going to take that away from them again. He's going to stop it so that they cannot worship God in the temple. And we're going to read more about that and find out what the reason for that is and what it means to us today. In verse 20, he now begins to tell him the interpretation. "The ram which thou sawest, having two horns, are the kings of the Media and Persian Empire." So here's what this one represents. It represents Media Persian Empire. So that's what he sees here with this ram. Now remember, this Medo-Persian Empire hasn't taken over Babylon yet. This is being prophesied that this is going to happen. To me, I think that's one of the reasons why when you read in the book of Daniel and you see this, you know that God is in control. He's telling him down to the days and the events of what's going to transpire. Now we go to verse 21. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. So this goat over here is the Grecian Empire. Now this is way down the road. This is a few hundred years down the road. But Daniel's being told this is what's going to happen. And not only is he being told that this kingdom's going to come, but he's being told that the great horn, the one who has this kingdom, Alexander the Great, is going to die, and it's going to be split into four. Well, how would anybody have known that hundreds of years before it occurred? God knows it, because he's causing it all to go the way he wants it to go, just like he will today. Just like he does with the rulers of the world, as he says, he sets them up and he takes them down. Now these four, notice, he says, they'll stand up, but not in the power of the great horn. They couldn't possibly stand up in the power of Alexander the Great, these four generals, because they divided all their forces up. They're four different kingdoms. During the time of these four kingdoms, and one of the other reasons for these four kingdoms and the waning of the power of the great horn is because of the fourth beast, which is the Roman Empire. And for the Roman Empire to gain its strength, then the Grecian Empire had to wane away. They didn't go in and just conquer the Grecian Empire. They just became and grew and become more and more stronger than these four generals and the empires or the kingdoms that they possessed. Now verse 23 through 26, he says, "And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practise, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And the vision of the evening and the morning, which was told, is true. Wherefore, shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days." So, Daniel's now told, look, this vision that you're seeing, it's in the future, Daniel. And obviously, Daniel's understanding, he's not going to be there to see it in its actuality. Now, he says, he begins to point his attention towards this little horn. I want you to notice a couple things about it. We already said that this little horn represents a man named as Antiochus Epiphany, and he gave his own self the title of Epiphany. He says here that through his policy, he's going to cause craft to prosper. In his hand, he shall magnify himself in his heart. So he's already saying what this man's going to be like. He thinks himself to be like a god. Now, what he does is, and we'll get more into this over in the future chapters, Lord willing, but what he does is he's after wealth. Wealth is what kingdoms needed to stay in power. They had to pay for their armies, they had to pay for their expansion, they had to pay for everything. Where he turns his attention to is Egypt. He's going to go over there to Egypt, who's very rich in gold and minerals, and he's going to conquer them. Well, he does. Well, the Roman Empire, now he does it really without them realizing it, that he attacks them. Once they get word of it, they send an old general down there to have a talk with him. And Antiochus, who thinks himself to be somebody really great, stands there with this Roman general. And this Roman general says, look, Rome don't want you here in Egypt. We want you to go home. And he says, well, give me some time to think about it. Well, this general took and drew a circle around him in the sand. And he says, when you step over this line, you will have given your answer. So he knew he didn't have time to go home and think about this. He didn't have time to figure out what he might do strategically. It was either, hey, I either tell them I'm going to leave Egypt, or they're going to send their armies against me. He knew he couldn't defeat the armies that Rome had gathered by this time. So he then said, I'll leave Egypt. Well, this, of course, you can imagine how upset it would make a man who considers himself to be like a god, a man who has set himself up on a pedestal, how this is making him feel now that somebody's come along and told him what he will or will not do. Meanwhile, back over there in Judea, back over there in Jerusalem, they've heard, and they have heard wrong. They think he's been killed, and the defeat that he's coming back, that he's been killed, he's not coming back. And so they just go on about business like, okay, everything's great now, this guy's gone. When he comes back and hears about all this, he's already angry about Egypt. He kills 40,000 Jews, men, women, children. He takes 40,000 more and sells them into slavery. So if you don't think that this is talking about some bad times that's about to come upon the people of Judea, we need to think again, because that's exactly what happens under this man. He sets it up in such a way they cannot even worship. He defiles the temple. He defiles the altar. He puts people to death that try to go to the temple and try to worship. And if you go and look in history, and there are some people who have Bibles that have two books in it that you don't find in the King James Version or in many of the versions today, because scholars didn't believe that they were books that were written that should have been added to the Bible. But there were two books written called the Maccabees. The Maccabees were the ones of family who did an uprising and finally defeats this man. So Daniel's concerned because, all right, these bad things are going to happen. Can you tell me when they're going to end? And this is the length of time he's given. It's going to be not a short period of time, especially if you're living through it. It's going to be pretty bad. But for 1,150 days, this man's going to take away your right to the worship there in Jerusalem. We'll try to cover the ninth chapter tonight. It shouldn't take us very long. In the ninth chapter, Daniel prays to God. Now, we're not going to read all of that. I think you can go home and read that for yourself. But the first 19 verses of it is Daniel praying to God. God, I know that Israel as a nation turned on you. I know Israel as a nation did not do what we should do, and that we were sinners and we were sinful, and I know we deserve this punishment of being taken out of our land. So Daniel is just pouring his heart out to God, and you should read it. It's a very good prayer. It's from a very devout man who is pouring out his heart to God, not only on his behalf, but on behalf of his nation, of his people. Then in verse 20, he picks up there and says, "While I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of my God, yea, while I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me about the time of the evening oblation. And he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give thee skill and understanding. At the beginning of thy supplication, the commandment came forth, and I came to show thee, for thou art greatly beloved, therefore understand the matter and consider the vision." So now Daniel has had this prayer. Gabriel, an angel, has now come to Daniel again, and he is now going to interpret something for Daniel. Daniel is wanting to know, what's going to happen here? What's going to transpire because of these? When's this 70 years going to end? He knows when the 70 years is going to end because he was taken into captivity. But when it ends, when are we going back? When's Jerusalem going to be rebuilt? The rest of this chapter deals with that in the last few verses. He's told, verse 24, 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness and to seal up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. So there's quite a bit been said here in this verse, and this is what is going to transpire, Daniel. So now he starts giving him the timeline. Know therefore and understand. So first thing that we look at here is that he has been given a total of 70 weeks. Now, remember, a day in prophecy becomes a year. And whereas we don't think that this one applied because the wording was used morning and evening instead of day, over here these apply. So if you take 70 weeks and you multiply by 7 days in a week, you get a total of 490 days. And since the day prophecy applies here, he's dealing with 490 years. So that's the span of time that's being given. Now he says, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the Prince, shall be 7 weeks, and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again, and the wall even in troublous times. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the Prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate." He's now given 3 events. He says there's going to be a term of 7 weeks. Then he says there's also going to be 62 weeks. And then there's going to be 1 week. Well, we know that 7 weeks equals 49. If you multiply it by 7, that 62 equals 434. And then you have your 7. When you total these together, you get the entire 490. Now, he's already said that in this 490 years, the Messiah is going to come. You may ask yourself then, as I've asked myself, why don't the Jews think Christ has come? Daniel said that within this 490 year period, he would come. Well, it's because they seem to think in their mind in some way that this last 7 is a futuristic time. They do not add it to these other weeks here. They take it away from this prophecy and push it out. We find nothing here, nothing, that tells us that this should be done. 490 years is a complete prophecy. It follows right into play. First of all, the commandment was given in 455 or 457 B.C. by Cyrus to go forth and to build the city of Jerusalem. The commandment's given. He said, understand this, from the time the commandment is given to restore Jerusalem is, and he begins this timeline. That was given because it simply, if you take 490 and subtract it away from when Christ was crucified, which was at 33.5 years, it'll take you over here to these numbers. There were several times that the commandment was actually given, but it was given 490 years before. Prior to that, actually, it was 486 and a half, as we'll cover here in a minute. It's going to take 49 of these years to go back and to build the city. It's going to be done in troublous times. If you read the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah stands before the king. He's saddened because his homeland is in destruction. He's told, okay, you can go back over and rebuild. The commandment is given. He's given everything he needs to go back and build. As they're trying to build it, they're being attacked by the people that live in the land. It's being said that they have a spear in one hand and they have a brick that they're laying in the other hand. So it was built, as he says here, in troublous times. Then he says you're going to have another span of 62 weeks or 434 years, and then the Messiah is going to come. We know that Jesus came on the scene when he was about 30 years old. Then he says there's going to be 1 week that he is going to confirm the covenant. And in the middle of that week, in the middle of 7 is 3.5, he's going to cause sacrifice and oblation to cease. So when Christ is crucified on the cross, he's the last sacrifice. There's no need for sacrifice no more. Even though that altar may still be over there at that temple, they don't need it no more. It doesn't mean anything no more because Christ has been crucified. So he became our sacrifice. It was in the middle of that week. So here he comes on the scene, and in the middle of that week, he's crucified. What ends that week is over in the book of Acts when the gospel is preached to the Gentiles, because it has been preached to the Jews only up until the time of Cornelius. Now it's delivered to the Gentiles, which opens up for the whole world. And that fulfills that this covenant has been confirmed for the 1 week period that ends over here. So, he then says that because of this sacrifice, and because he causes sacrifice and oblations to cease, in verse 27 at the end, he says, "And for the overspreading of abominations, he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate." What he's speaking of there is what transpires in 70 AD. From the time that Christ is crucified on the cross, and if you look at a dictionary, it's going to say that it was in 30 AD. We say it was in 33 because we know Jesus was about 33 years old. So we give it 33, but the timeline of the Gregorian calendar that we're under says it is 30 AD when Christ was crucified. You add 40 years to that and you come to 70 AD. And we know that 40 plays a big part in the Bible because Jesus was 40 days in the wilderness, Moses was 40 days in the mount, and we also know that the children of Israel wandered for 40 years in the wilderness. And 40 is always a time of proving. So between the time that Christ came, ended the sacrifice, he said he made it so that the temple would be desolate. And it did. In 70 AD, Titus went upon the city of Jerusalem and destroyed it, and destroyed the temple. And you remember we talked about that a while back, how there was gold, and how gold melted and went between the bricks. And so the Romans who were wanting that gold went in there and tore it down to nothing to get the gold out. And that fulfilled the prophecy that Jesus said, "There'll not be a stone left upon a stone. Even in the floor, there won't be nothing left." Because they went in there and tore it apart to get the gold out that ran down in the ground as it melted. So this brings to conclusion of the 9th chapter in the book of Daniel. We'll, Lord willing, as we said, pick up with the 10th chapter next time. And it will we'll begin to explain more and more about Antiochus Epiphany the IV here, and about what this little horn here represents, and how not only does it represent what goes on during that time in Israel, but how quite possibly that points to something that's going to transpire in the world before the world itself ends when Christ comes back. There be one this evening. Won't you come while we stand and sing?